I'm Robin D.G. Kelly. And this is Errol Garner Uncovered. Who is Errol Garner to you?
Anything that passed through his hands and his mind was transformed into to the point where it just sounds like he made it up. Like, he invented the instrument, he invented the song. It could be a Beatles song. I didn't even know that that was a Beatles song. That's an Errol Garner song. You know what I mean? He's obviously playing the piano, but he's also playing so many different instruments when he plays the piano. To be able to take anything and then filter it through you and have it be transformed, but still, you know, still use all these tools that are at your disposal. I mean, it's just, it's so exciting. It's so exciting. And to do it with love, love for the audience, love for the people listening to it. You know, it's wild.
I'm Pete Lockhart, senior producer for Octave Music. On this episode of Errol Garner Uncovered, we welcome Cecile McLaurin-Salvant. She and Dr. Kelly dive into Garner's 1972 album Gemini and explore Salvant's deep relationship to his song Misty. As a multidisciplinary artist herself, Salvant shares her insights into Garner's visual art practice and what inspired her essay on the topic for his centennial box set, Liberation in Swing. Here's your host, Robin D.G. Kelly.
First of all, it is such an honor to have the legendary Cecile McLaurin-Salvant as my guest on Errol Garner Uncovered. And I won't lie, I'm terrified. For my listeners, you certainly don't need an introduction, but let me try. Cecile is the recent recipient of the MacArthur Genius Grant, as well as the Doris Duke Artist Award. She is a bona fide genius, not a fake genius, but like a pure bona fide genius. She grew up in Miami, Florida. Her father's from Haiti. Her mother born in Tunisia, but of French and Guadeloupean and American heritage. She holds a law degree from one of the most prestigious universities in France, which she earned while studying Baroque music and jazz at the Darius Milhaud Music Conservatory. She is a scholar, a visual artist, a multimedia curator, a filmmaker, an activist, a fashion maven, a mean piano player, a composer, and in her spare time, she sings. She sings everywhere. She sings in concert halls, amphitheaters, in clubs, and airports. Her impromptu rendition of Spring Will Really Hang You Up the Most at Charles de Gaulle Airport compelled dozens of passengers to miss their flights and exchange their tickets for whatever flight she was on. Okay, well, maybe not. But if I was there, that's what I would have done. I would have, I don't care where I'm going. I'm going to go to Marseille with this amazing woman singing this song. Now, I probably should mention the fact that she made a few albums along the way. Her first release was when she was about 20 or 21. She could clarify for me, in 2010, which is the same year she won the Thelonious Monk International Jazz Competition. She went on to record 4 award-winning albums on the Mac Avenue label, Woman Child, For One to Love, Dreams and Daggers, and The Window, 3 of which won Grammys. All 4 were nominated. She is exactly 1 year and 12 days older than my daughter and has more awards than anyone I know. She is an artist with a cosmopolitan vision of the world and a deep appreciation and understanding of histories that we've too often suppressed or buried. And she is fearless. In so many ways, she dreams big dreams like Errol Garner, but has been able to realize them in ways that he could not. And she's just getting started. So welcome to the show, Cecile.
Thank you. I cannot believe what you just said. This is wild. But thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's all true. And so let's begin. We're going to begin where I always begin with my guests. And that is, who is Errol Garner to you?
So I will start. What I'll say probably seems like it's has nothing to do with what we're talking about. But for the last 5, 6 days, every single day I have woken up in the worst mood possible. I mean, I am the Grinch walking around. Everything gets me so angry. I mean, the other day, it might have been even yesterday, I was walking around my neighborhood in the worst mood. And people were out, you know, with their families, having lunch, enjoying themselves. And it was starting to rain. And I was like, yeah, I'm so glad it's going to rain on their Sunday. And I was just so mean. And I put on Gemini to just remind myself by Errol Garner to, you know, to get into the zone for today's talk. And it reminded me of the gift that is Errol Garner, because to me, I mean, he was like a ray of sunshine. He made me laugh. He made me feel happier. And then he made me kinder.
Mm.
And so for him to, you know, that's my personal experience. But I've been thinking a lot about what it means to, you know, bring more kindness into the world and how art and music can do that. Empathy and kindness. Those are really big ideas that I've been just thinking about a lot. And Errol Garner to me is just such an example of that.
Right.
And
right.
I walked around with just more generosity, kindness, joy, kindness of spirit, you know, with every step that I took listening to him. And so that's my answer for today. That's my answer for right now. He's healing. He's a palliative.
Right.
Look at me. I'm as helpless as a kitten up a tree. And I feel like I'm clinging to a cloud I can't understand. I get misty just holding your hand.
Another thing for me is that the first song that I really connected with was Misty, sung by Sarah Vaughan. And so for a very long time, I had that connection with him, which was unknown to me. I didn't even know.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know who wrote that song. And I had I was so stuck on that song. Like, we can be stuck on certain songs for years and years. And to know that this genius player, this incredible player, is responsible for that song, which sort of carried me throughout my teens, another awkward moment in life.
Right.
I'm just so grateful to him. And right. I could go on and on, but I'll just start with that.
Yeah, well, you know what? We're gonna go on and on in a second, but before we do that, let's take a moment to listen to the rendition of Misty that's on Gemini. And just some background. In 1971, when he made this recording, he had made an earlier recording that year for the film Play Misty for Me that Clint Eastwood had basically commissioned. And there was a big struggle, you know, over whether or not they're going to edit it. And Martha Glaser, his manager, said no editing. And they went back and forth. And so he went into the studio and made another version in April. This very beautiful version we're about to listen to. And just in my own personal opinion, it's probably the finest studio rendition of Misty he's ever made. And we happen to have it on the Octave reissue. So let's listen to it, and let me just get your reaction to it, and let's talk about it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Oh my gosh, so many thoughts.
Yeah, give them all.
And feelings. So one thing that came to me while we listened was, wow, he really loves us. You know, he really loves his listener.
Right.
And you feel that love from him. I mean, he's it feels like he's serenading whoever it is that's listening to him.
That's
and
right.
There's a very intimate personal connection that he is establishing with his listener. And the other thing that I thought is how, like, it just feels so grand. And that harp figure, that feeling of, you know, those harps just announcing you. That's what it feels like when you hear that. It's just harps and harps. And it makes me think of, you know, just all of the, I don't want to say baggage in a bad way, but all of the accumulated knowledge that this man had and how he was able to tap into something like a harp for a song.
Right.
Or, you know, he's obviously playing the piano, but he's also playing so many different instruments when he plays the piano. I mean, we talk a lot about the fact that he sounds, you know, his left hand sometimes sounds like a guitar or sometimes sounds like percussion, or, you know, he knows how to play the instrument from so many different angles that you forget that it's a piano. And with this song, Misty, which is, you know, his song, he's playing the harp. He's playing, there's a group of harpists that are playing for us. And that figure is on his left hand, and he's repeating it and repeating it. And I'm very interested also with him in his use of repetition as, I can only guess at his intentions, but I find that repetition is one of the most important devices in art, especially in an art that happens through time, right? That's fleeting. It's for the listener something that's very important. And so to have these repeated figures, to have this repeated harp throughout is, it's brilliant and it's just so grand.
Yes, that is so true. You know, the great late philosopher James Sneed wrote a brilliant essay on repetition in Black art. And it is, and he applied it to everything. And everything you just said really is sort of captures, you know, James Sneed's insights on so many, even, you know, as an artist yourself, I mean, repetition of line, you know, of form. I mean, all these things are really, really important. And the amazing thing, too, is that this is a song that he first recorded in 1954. He wrote it on a plane. The plane is in turbulence, and he's, like, writing it in his head.
Wow.
I mean, he's you know, because he didn't write music down despite the fact that the idea of him, you know, not being musically literate is such a myth, because literacy doesn't mean writing on a page. It means having a kind of knowledge of the structure of music and being able to convey it. But he's on the plane, and he's sitting next to a woman who thinks that he's going crazy because he's humming, and he's hearing all the melodies. You know, he's hearing the melody and all the harmonic elements of it, and by the time he lands, he has a song. So, and for something he's played so often and to hear it fresh every time, that's just, you know, an art. I want to go back to your life, because I've seen you play piano, and I know you play. I know, you may disagree with me, but I think you're an amazing pianist. I think there's so many vocalists who are great pianists, like Sarah Vaughan, for example, yourself. And, you know, and you grew up playing piano. And I'd love for you to bring us back to your household growing up in Miami, all the music you listened to. I know that people have said that you kind of discovered jazz in Paris, but I'm skeptical. I feel like it was already there. somehow. And who, and just one last thing. I mean, in your interview with Essence Magazine, when you were asked, like, how would you introduce someone to the music, you mentioned two artists. You said, well, you can go through Robert Glasper or go through Earl Garner. That's 2015 you said that. So you've had Earl Garner on your shoulder for a long time. You know, that's how I see it. So take us back to your formation, your relationship to piano, like how you came to this music.
This is insane. I have so many thoughts running around. Interesting that first suggestion I make to anyone asking is piano players, two piano players, right? It is the first instrument that I played. It is my mother, when I was 3 or 4 years old, decided that she wanted me to learn an instrument. And I went and I, you know, started playing little songs, little easy songs for kids, you know, drew my hand and figured out what the notes were for each finger. And it was part of my life throughout all of my primary school up until the end of high school. I was doing these piano lessons weekly that I didn't really want to do. So it's always been a part of my life. I was brought up in a home where music was one of the great sources of joy and comfort. Dancing to the music was very important. My mother has extremely eclectic musical taste. And so we were listening to all kinds of stuff, including jazz, from a very young age. Mm-hmm. And Earl Garner was a big part of that. So was Thelonious Monk. Mm-hmm. So were the great, you know, jazz singers like Sarah Vaughan and Nancy Wilson and Billie Holiday. But there was also this whole world of folk music from all over the world. My mother traveled a lot. As you said, she was born in Tunisia. She lived throughout Africa. She lived in Cuba. She lived in South America, all before the age of, you know, 22. Mm-hmm. And so she carries all of those different cultures with her. The music, the food, the visual art, and she shared it with my sister and I. And so so I was brought up with that love of all kinds of music with no limitation in terms of genre, country, era. It all was coming at me. And you know what? The beauty of being a child is everything comes at you at an equal, you know, it's on an equal plane. You don't know that Monk is, you know, gone when you're listening to him. You just think, oh, you know, and you don't, there's nothing strange about listening to Earl Garner 1 minute and then Yusun Dur or Cesaria Evora the next minute. Right. It's just beautiful music. And so I was very lucky to be brought up in that environment. And it sort of shaped the way that I listen to music now and that I engage with culture now. And I try to remember that boundlessness, that freedom in just, you know, immersing yourself with culture, you know, mm-hmm. without any prejudice. I try to tap into that.
Right. Well, it's really, it comes through in all your music, and which is why it's so hard to use any label to describe your music. You know, it's everywhere. I mean, you're one of the few people I know who have a deep appreciation for the genius of Burt Williams, who I just think is one of the unsung figures and great artists and just a remarkable human being. And,
oh, absolutely.
You know, and, you know, it's like, and it's the same with, in some ways, for Earl Garner, because, you know, part of doing this podcast, part of the release of this amazing box set is a kind of reintroduction to the world of someone who has always been considered, yeah, he's really good. But, you know, he's not Oscar Peterson.
Serious.
Or, exactly. He's like, somehow he's not there. And when what we're discovering is, of course, that's absolutely not true. And what I love about your deep dive into the musical traditions is how you bring up music that is really amazing art, that's edgy, that's very powerful, that's rooted in the folk meaning not unlearned, but folk meaning deeply rich. And you bring all that to the surface, and you force us to actually come to terms with a much bigger tradition than what we've inherited in the past. So having said that, I would love if you could just join me in kind of exploring this album that, you know, you've been listening to, Gemini. I mean, this was a record that was released in 1972 by London Records. And it was at a time in Garner's life when he hadn't produced he hadn't recorded an album for 2 years. It was very late in his life. He was becoming known as a pop artist, which is amazing to me, but
I love it.
Yeah, you know,
I love it.
It's like feeling is believing came before that, and they kept expecting a pop album, and what they got was something that had a really interesting eclectic mix. It had a snippet of Something by the Beatles. It had a lot of the old standards that he'd played, as well as some originals. The title Gemini, of course, refers to the astrological sign. He was born June 15th, 1921. He is a twin. His brother, Ernest, is his twin brother. So he's really playing with the whole notion of what it means to be a Gemini. You know,
you know, can I cut you off just 1 second?
Oh, yeah.
Is that I feel like every time anyone talks about Earl Garner, I'm like learning this major stuff about him. He's a twin.
Yes,
this is wild.
He's a twin.
I'm sorry.
Oh no, this
I'm just like wow.
You know, a lot of people didn't know that about him. Of course, he comes from a very musical family and all that. But Gemini is his album that kind of represents, as Dan Morgenstern puts it in the liner notes, a certain duality, an unpredictability, which is Gemini, you know, and that's Earl. For Two. Just to set up this recording, I love this recording, by the way. So he's playing T for Two, which is a kind of classic piano jam. Like all the stride pianists in the days, if you could master T for Two like Art Tatum, then you've mastered that instrument. So he takes T for Two, and underneath are what the late vocalist and my dear friend Setima B. Benjamin calls Cape Town rhythms. I mean, we hear them as West African, but they're really Southern African rhythms. These are Cape Town rhythms that underneath what he plays, and he starts with the harpsichord, moves to the piano, and he knows a harpsichord. He knows that you can't play those elaborate chords. He plays it like a guitar, you know. It's lovely.
With the harpsichord for years and years now. I've sung with harpsichords back when I was living in France and even now in New York from time to time. I love early music. I love the harpsichord. I listen to the harpsichord. I did not know that this was a harpsichord when I first heard this album.
Right.
And I had no idea what it could be. I thought, is this some kind of strange new synth? Is this what strange new instrument? Is this like some kind of guitar that's like, that he's somehow playing like a piano? I'm so glad I didn't read the liner notes. I know that's bad. I'm going to read them now. But I loved being immersed in an instrument that seemed completely strange and new. Mm-hmm. And yet, it's just the good old harpsichord that I know and love. And that's such a testament to his approach to that instrument and to the piano, too, because he really makes it a totally new, different sounding instrument. And I would venture to say that perhaps if we didn't know Errol Garner so well and we didn't associate him with the piano so much, there might be that kind of disconnect if we had heard him, you know, and said, what is that? Is that a piano? Is that keys? And he really has this just such a unique way of hitting that harpsichord to where you're thinking that surely that's some kind of strange guitar.
Right.
Right?
I felt the same way.
And I love that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I love feeling that. And actually, when you mentioned it, you mentioned harpsichord. I thought, I wanted to scream. I thought, what? That's what this was, you know?
Yeah. No, you're so right. It does not sound like a harpsichord. Not that I've heard before. I mean, it really does sound like he figured out a way to play the guitar a certain kind of way.
Yeah.
And he's so smart and so, I mean, his ears are so attuned to what the instrument can do. Because he doesn't actually apply his same piano skills to that instrument. He does something different, which I thought's amazing.
It's amazing. I think there's appearance of harpsichord on another track earlier on the album. It's super unusual. And I remember hearing that harpsichord and thinking, who's playing? I thought it was another person because the approach was so different. The instrument was different. I just thought, who is that?
Mm-hmm.
And it's him. And it's funny because it's like the whole idea of this Gemini concept, you know, these twins, right? A double, right? It just feels like a weird, bizarro Errol that's playing a solo after the regular Errol that you know, and you're just like, where are we? You know, and so it's just, it's so apt. That title is so apt because of that, because to think that it's two different people
mm-hmm.
when right. it's the same person is wild.
So you're going to make a harpsichord recording now.
Well, I've been thinking about early instruments for a long time. And I actually have just finished an album. I don't want to be this person talking about my album. Let's talk about Errol.
But I would love to hear about it. We all would love to hear about it because of course, we're communing with Errol. And Errol is right here, and he's like, I want to hear about this album.
Well, all I'll say is I have been taking lute lessons.
Oh.
I have a Renaissance lute here that I sometimes pull out and sing a couple songs. I'm not good at it. But I've been really enjoying taking lute lessons. Mm-hmm. And now with the pandemic, I can't anymore, but I invited my lute teacher to play on my album.
Wow.
And so we have a track where he's playing lute and theorbo on a song that I wrote. And so I'm just excited. I'm excited about, you know, there's just such a wealth. There's so many instruments that are not heard enough, that are not played enough, that are absolutely beautiful, that have these strange sounds that, you know, it feels like languages, you know, like there's such a sadness when a language dies, right? And I was watching this Werner Herzog movie where he talks about the fact that, like, I don't know, every 12 minutes a language dies or something. Maybe that's an exaggeration, but when an instrument, when that sound is sort of brought back into a new context, into a context that's not paying tribute to the music that it originated with, it feels like, you know, integrating pieces of a forgotten language, of an old language. It feels like when I see these YouTube videos of people having conversations in Latin, and it excites me. It excites me because I feel like there's such, the world is so rich. It's so rich with such variety of sounds and flavors and, I was going to say, and smells. And that we've too, all right. just, you know, we've, everything is so, it's so flattened out in some ways. And so, I don't know, I just get excited hearing Errol Garner play harpsichord.
Right.
And
right.
I get excited singing with a lute because why not, you know?
Yeah, well, I really look forward to hearing that. It's interesting because I've written about a musician by the name of Ahmed Abdul Malik, who was a bass player, but he also played oud. And oud, of course, is like the Egyptian lute. I mean, basically.
And it's the father.
Right.
Right.
And it's just, and you're so right to hear the music in a different context. And yet there's nothing that seems foreign. You know, it seems so organic. Like, okay, that makes sense. It's a different sound, but it's something organic about it. And when you think about it, well, people speaking Latin, there was a time when that was the root of all the Western languages. So
it's so funny because you talk to people and you say, you know, I know a few people who took Latin in school, right? Mm-hmm. And you go, well, you know, say something. And they're like, well, no, you're not supposed to say it. You know, you're not supposed to speak it. You just read it and write it. And I'm like, what's the point?
Right.
You should be able to, if you studied Latin, you should be able to go on and have a conversation.
Exactly.
And you so the freedom of, you know, it's similar to an instrument because it's just like saying, well, no, a harpsichord, you're supposed to just do continuo and you're supposed to just play Purcell and Monteverdi and that's it. And you're not supposed to play it with a rhythm section, you know? And to say, no, why? It's alive. Everything is alive. Like, let's, you know, that boundlessness that Errol had.
Right.
And the fact that anything that passed through his hands and his mind was transformed into the point where it just sounds like he made it up. Mm-hmm. Like, he invented the instrument. He invented the song. It could be a Beatles song. I didn't even know that was a Beatles song.
Something,
that's Errol Garner song.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's such an aspirational thing for anybody who's you know in a creative pursuit to be able to take anything and then filter it through you and have it be transformed, but still, you know, still use all these tools that are at your disposal. I mean, it's so exciting. It's so exciting, and to do it with love. Love for the audience.
Right. Exactly.
Love for the people listening to it.
Yeah.
You know, it's wild. I mean, I also think about Errol Garner's music as it relates to dance and sort of the history of jazz and American popular culture and how it's sort of lost its link to dance.
Mm-hmm.
And with Garner, it's almost like, I don't know. It's almost like he extended that link a little bit longer than it actually was. You know, it just feels like it is music for dancers in a way that I don't think my music is for dancers. You know what I mean? I feel like we've really lost that priority.
Mm-hmm.
And when I hear Garner, I hear that at the center of it too.
Right.
And it's exciting to me. And I think again of that idea of just the how rich it was, how dense and rich and full of different expressions this music can be and was, and how exciting it is to get a glimpse of that.
Right, right. You know, you probably know this, but he had aspirations to write for ballet. I mean, this is one of the tragedies of his life, is that he had these dreams of really breaking out of the box of playing trios and quartets, you know, around the world. He wanted to write for ballet. He wrote for ballet, actually, just, you know, it didn't really come to fruition. He wanted to write soundtracks. So he thought about dancers, much like Charles Mingus thought about dancers, you know, when he did Black Saint and the Sinner Lady, you know, which was really a ballet. And so he thought of his music as tone poems in many ways. He really tried to break out of the box that they kept putting him in. And it's just too bad that he died so young, because he probably would have been able to achieve that or lived another period. Oftentimes, people think of Garner's music as happy, but for the wrong reasons. That it's happy in 1968 or 1972, when much of the world of, much of the black world, the world of fighting against forms of oppression, are not happy, that they're angry. And here comes Earl, he could reassure us. But here's someone who cared, like you said, he cared about us. He loved us. And his happiness was about resilience and reminding us who we are as human beings as we fight these fights, as we struggle to try to make a better world. And that's who he was, you know. And he was funny.
Well, we need celebrations of black joy too.
Yes.
You know, I'm the number one person to, I love to lament. I love to go into the darkness and you know, really get down and like down in the depths of it. But we do need celebrations of black joy.
Yes.
And through complexity, through this there is so much complexity to the way that he plays, to his approach of music. There are so many unexpected twists and turns. You look at Errol Garner's introductions, and then when they get into the song, like that is a lesson in, you know, subverting expectations, right? You know, we think about an Errol Garner, we think about a Louis Armstrong as these figures that, you know, it's us applying another type of racism to say, well, you know, they're just cooning or they're just whatever it is, right? Uncle Tom. And it's such a reductive, you know, racist way to look at it.
Yeah,
they're both radical.
I know, I could not agree with you more. In fact, so let's talk about another song on this album, which builds precisely on this conversation. And, you know, there are two originals, two Garner originals. One is Gemini, the title track, and El Dorado. Which he wrote after his car, or after the El Dorado, which, you know, for my generation, El Dorado was like, if you're a hip, you drive an El Dorado. Now, that song is so interesting. It's 56 bars, an AABA form, the A section 16 bars, and an 8-bar bridge, and the harmonies are really sophisticated. And yet, it's a simple, funky song, you know, it's like grassroots, it's grounded. It's something about it, and it really captures that sense of danceability that you talk about.
Oh, I just love it. I just think that form is so strange and striking to me. Mm-hmm. And I love it. It's like asymmetrical with the shorter bridge. I love it. I love it.
Right.
Incredible. I'm glad you told me it was about the car, because I would have thought it was about, you know, the city of gold. That's where I went.
That's what I thought. You know, I swear I thought it was that until I, you know, did a little bit more research. And, you know, in some ways, the city of gold and the car may be the same thing. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
One of the things I have had the pleasure of discovering is your artwork, your visual work, your drawings, your animation. And I know that you are working on Ogress, which is a musical fable using your artwork animated and drawing on all kinds of musical genres to also tell the story, partly of the Venus Hottentot, or Sarah Bartman. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to be such a great artist on top of everything else, and your inspiration, and tell us a little bit about Ogress, and then we'll talk about Earl's work.
You're very sweet. I was surrounded by people making art from a really young age, but making it casually, making it with no exhibition in view, making it with no gallery in view. And that's my mom and sister.
Uh-huh.
They both painted, paint, and do sculpture and textile work and carpentry. And my mother makes lace and embroidery. I mean, there's all kinds of pottery. There's constantly a new phase of of exploration in art.
Wow.
But the fact that they did it behind closed doors at home with no fanfare has been for me the greatest influence, artistic influence in my life. And I always go back to that. I always go back to thinking about my sister making oil paintings in her house that no one will ever see, that she will not share. And, you know, the joy and playfulness of doing that with absolutely none of that ambition that clouds things, none of that, you know, the monetization of it and what that means and how that clouds things. Just the pure joy of saying, what's going to be my project this weekend?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was brought up with that thinking. And so my visual art practice has always been in that spirit.
Mm-hmm.
It's always just been like, oh, we're waiting for a flight. Let me do this instead of, I don't know, scrolling on Facebook again. So it built up from there. And I started getting more and more into embroidery and developing this sort of visual vocabulary as the years went by. Out of this initial shyness, because my mother and sister were so great. So I thought, there's no room for me to be making any stuff. And then eventually getting into it.
Mm-hmm.
And really getting into making these really big, big drawings on textile. Because, partly because it's my heritage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm inheriting it from my grandmother. from both cultures. You know, my French grandmother who used to do all kinds of embroideries, but also this whole tradition of textile work in Haiti on my dad's side. So all of that is just, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. And also the fact that when you're working on textile and you're making a large drawing on a piece of fabric, you can actually make it huge because you just fold it up and put it in the bag. You know, right. It's not the same constraints as working on paper. And on top of that, there is the added sort of attraction that I have for things that are disdained, that are thought of as, oh no, this is just women's work, or this is just, you know, mm-hmm. domestic, this is just craft. You're just making a tablecloth. And so, you know, all of that kind of comes together when I'm drawing, and it's become this source of just pure playfulness that mm-hmm. I'm trying to tap into even when I'm making music now.
Right.
So I'm trying to say, well, you know, how did I draw this? Because now music has become this thing where, you know, there is a little bit of pressure, there's a little bit of expectation, and the relationship with an audience is totally different than if you're making visual art, right?
Exactly.
You're constantly feeling out what people's reaction is, especially if you're performing live. Like, you know how they're, I mean, you don't know, but you can kind of see how they're accepting or mm-hmm. you know, how they're experiencing the music versus drawing. You just do your own thing and then, you know, put it up, and maybe, you know, you don't even need to see who gets to see it.
Right.
But so there's something really freeing about that for me.
Her skin was chocolate brown. Upon her head she wore a crown.
And I'll just say that Ogress was this way for me to start to bring all of these things together, to start to bring the visual vocabulary, that the language that I had started creating with these big women, and, you know, have this fable that I wrote start to move visually,
mm-hmm.
and according to what I am imagining visually. And so it's a really exciting project because it finally feels like, okay, now we're multimedia, now we're interdisciplinary, now we're bringing together, like, it seems so crazy that it took me this long to realize that animation is the way to make drawings move to music. Like, mm-hmm. that is what that is. Right. So, and you know, not to get too deep into it, but the fact that the story of Ogress is a story of the fetishization of the black female body. It's right. The story of the Venus Hottentot. It's the story of all of these cycles of appropriation in our culture. And it's also about, you know, the diaspora, the African diaspora, and all of those challenges to then bring it to a medium like animation, which the roots of animation are in blackface and minstrelsy.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those techniques and all of that visual language in those initial animated films comes from that Mickey Mouse glove, which is the glove of Burt Williams, you know? I'm also excited and astonished that this is the first feature-length animation
mm-hmm.
by a black woman.
Right.
Directed by a black woman. If we can make it.
Oh, yes. No, that you have to really underscore that. That is an absolute fact. And this is what's so astounding about it. Not only would it be the first feature-length animation, but it's one that tells a story that is so foundational to, you know, the making of the race and gender structures that we've inherited. And it's,
but you know, it makes me think of, you know, when we think of Garner and all of these plans mm-hmm. and projects that he had, you know, the limitations that are in reality, you know, you mm-hmm. have these ideas, and, you know, Ogress is this this grand idea. You know, animation is like a feature-length animation is this grand idea, and I'm trying to go for it. But to be honest, there's a lot of limitations. Like, it's very hard. It's very expensive. It has to, we have to have all these people on board and willing and excited to do it. And I think about Garner a lot because I think he had all these plans for stuff that he wanted to do. And there were just too many limitations. And one of which was time, right?
Exactly.
One of which was just the sheer brevity of his life, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think about that a lot.
Right, right. You know, one of the things which is also significant for Garner, and I think relevant to this conversation, is that he, and with help from Martha Glaser, was able to make enough money to actually collect artwork very early on in his life. I mean, he was a collector in his 30s. And a serious collector. And this is a side of him that sometimes got pressed, but not always. And as a collector, it inspired his own artwork. And I know that you're one of the few on the planet who actually had access to see the works of art, the drawings that Garner left behind. And I'm wondering, and I should also add that as a result of your examination of this work, your background, your knowledge, you wrote this absolutely gorgeous, stunning essay as part of the Octave box set, Liberation and Swing. And I'm wondering if you can share your reaction to the work, its impact on you, and maybe some of the ideas that are laid out in this wonderful essay of yours.
Sure. I mean, I was... First of all, very surprised to find out that he had a visual art practice, and also a little bit afraid to see what it was, because thinking it's probably not good. I mean, he's such an amazing musician. It can't be good, right? And then seeing the work and being absolutely astounded at how beautiful it is. And also, I'll admit, a little frustrated that there's not more, that I can't see more. Which is, you know, what a brat. What a spoiled brat to go from not having anything and then seeing all this beautiful work and saying, well, but no, we need more now. I want to see more.
Right.
But it was really exciting to see it. And he's got this astonishing, like, first of all, the sense of line is beautiful and amazing, and you can tell that he's not, these are not doodles,
right?
You know, from somebody who doesn't have a clue. they're very informed, and they're very beautiful pieces, and quite poetic, and very playful. It's funny, I anthropomorphize everything. Everything. If I see abstract art, I'm putting a face on it. I'm finding the face. I'm finding the story. I'm finding, like, the human relationships within that work.
Right.
It's very hard for me to stay in an abstract realm. And I love it. I love anthropomorphizing things. Mm-hmm. So it's funny because I do that when I look at Errol's work.
Mm-hmm.
I know that some of it is not abstract. Some of it is figurative. But most of it, I think, is abstract, but not for me. I have storylines for every single, and they change every time I look at them. So, I really enjoy them. I think I go back and look at them quite a bit, actually, because they're just wonderful.
Right, right. And at the end of the essay, you talk about your own confession that you've been doing this work for years, for at least a decade now. And I love that you write, ultimately, when I make drawings or look at work by artists I love, when I engage with visual art in some way, I lose track of time. I'm enraptured. Garner's work is an encouragement to continue studying, to pursue our passions, to make something and revel in the privacy of it. And those are your words. you are someone who, you channel so many artists, among them Ella Fitzgerald. This was a song that Ella really made famous, you know, I mean, How High the Moon. And it's one of those songs that a lot of people play, sing, and here is Earl probably just at his, not, I'm going to say most virtuosic, but it's a display of virtuosity on that keyboard.
So that left hand is insane. And it's funny. A lot of people, a lot of pianists will sometimes go into an Earl Garner vibe at some point in their solo, but they never, they'll always do a certain type of left-hand thing that Earl, certain type of left-hand figure that Earl Garner does. They don't do this one.
Right.
Because this one is
super hard.
Hard.
Right.
Energizes you. It's just so energizing. I can't. There's so many things that I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about that left hand, and just the driving force that is that left hand, the percussive forces that left hand, the, you know, splashes of surprise from that left hand. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about also, you know, the variations and the fact that he goes into, like, he'll go into one vibe and he'll repeat it for you. And right. then you familiarize yourself with it as the listener. And then he'll go into another and repeat it for you and familiarize, you know, and he also leads the band that way. So the band knows what they're going to play, what those hits are, because it's organized. The structure is there. The solo is not some nebulous, like, searching, meandering, I don't know. Like, he's holding us and he's carrying us. And it is insane to be doing that while at the same time dealing with all of these polyrhythms,
right.
while at the same time having this incredible melodic sense, which is just so engaging and beautiful. I mean, the melodies alone, all of these elements by themselves would be fantastic. And the fact that they're all coming together means also that as a listener, we are so lucky to have a recording because we can just go back and focus on one element, right? Mm-hmm. And I love doing that. I mean, it's like reading a good poem. Like, you like it at first, but there's so much stuff coming at you. But if you just focus on, like, let me focus on the words that feel light only on this, you know, so something like this type of track, it's like, let's just focus on the left hand
right.
only
right.
and listen to the whole track, just listening to the left hand and trying to block out any other information. And then let's just focus on the different themes that he goes through each time, you know, he takes a chorus or each time he goes into a section, and think about the ways that he approaches repetition. And let's look at how he interacts with the band and how he leads his, and there's so many different angles to listen to it that it just becomes this endless joy because, you know, I heard this track yesterday, I heard it this morning, and I'm hearing it now, and it's such different experiences every time. And it's so fun. It's so fun to like immerse yourself in that world.
Right. Right. Well, you know, I've heard it, I don't know, a couple dozen times, but I've never heard it with you. So now it's totally different. It's like, oh my
exactly.
God. I did see this is exactly why we have these conversations, because I've learned so much from you and just hearing through your ears. It's just really astounding, and it will never sound the same to me again. Mm-hmm.
it's just been a joy to listen to this with you. What a joy to speak about this. I mean, seminal figure of culture, of pop culture, even. Mm-hmm. Let's go ahead and get, you know.
That's right.
He's got it all. He's pop, and he's also like this profound intellectual gem of just like expression on so many different angles. I mean, I'm in such a good mood. You should have seen me yesterday. You should have seen how I started my day yesterday. You would be shocked to see how good my mood is because of this.
Yeah, well, I'm so happy about that. And it's so funny because I was a mess yesterday because I had my second shot for my vaccine. So I was sick and fever and slept all day. Yeah. I said, how am I going to do this? And then as soon as I heard your voice, I'm like, oh my God. First I heard your voice, then I melted and had to put myself back together again. So once I did that, I'm like, okay, well, we could do this. And it's like you, me, and Errol Garner, it's like ultra joy. And this has been one of the great, great experiences of my entire life, unforgettable. Earl will never sound the same to me again. And I just want to thank you for taking the time. I know your time is precious. And we're just going to, you know, continue to wait until that new album drops and move on with our lives with joy and with direction and with unpredictability, you know, which is a great thing. So
thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course.
Thank you so much.
Errol Garner Uncovered is a production of Octave Music. This episode was produced and edited by me, Pete Lockhart, with Michael Saltzman. Our executive producer is Susan Rosenberg. You can find the newly expanded and remastered edition of Gemini anywhere you listen to music, and get more info on our whole series and the new box set, Liberation and Swing, at errolgarner.com. On our next episode, we welcome Robert Glasper. He and Dr. Kelly explore Garner's last studio album, 1974's Magician. Subscribe now. You won't want to miss it. We'll